WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is Archibald Cox, a leading authority on constitutional law and labor law. He is now the Carl M. Loeb University Professor Emeritus at Harvard University. Professor Cox has held a number of positions in federal government, including chairman of the Wage Stabilization Board in 1952. During the 1960 presidential campaign, he was one of Senator John F. Kennedy's principal advisors and was appointed by President-elect Kennedy as the new Solicitor General of the United States. In May 1973, Archibald Cox became the first Watergate Special Prosecutor, setting up and directing the Watergate Special Prosecution Force until he was fired at the request of President Nixon in October 1973. Archibald Cox has written several books on labor law, civil rights, the Supreme Court, and freedom of expression, and his new book, published by Houghton Mifflin Company, is entitled The Court and the Constitution. Welcome to Fresh Air, Professor Cox.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here on this auspicious day.
Well, it is a wonderful day to be here in Philadelphia, both to reflect on the accomplishments of the past and also on the challenge and opportunities passed on to us to try to do as much the same thing as we can for our children and their children.
And that's exactly why we're talking.
Yes,
to you today.
And I'm sure that's what the framers would wish us to do if they could be here, to think of the future and the obligations that go with it as well as the opportunities, and not just of them in the past.
Mm. Let's talk just a little bit about the past, though, because the first chapter of your book, The Court and the Constitution, you call it the miracle at Philadelphia. Miracle. Interesting word.
I stole that title from a Philadelphian, Catherine Drinker Bowen, who wrote a wonderful, fascinating book under that title quite a few years ago. She stole it from George Washington. And I think James Madison also spoke of the miracle, because remember, it took from May to September, and there were times when the delegates were insulting each other so that almost at the stage of, there's no use sitting down together tomorrow. Then they appointed a committee, and they stuck at it and finally did come up with the Constitution, an extraordinary document. I sometimes think that even more miraculous than the delegates from these jealous, selfish states, even more miraculous than their coming together was the miracle that the Constitution, with a few very important changes, but very few, as a document has survived 200 years with no other changes in the text, in the basic document. It's unique in that respect to other constitutions, many rather patterned after it, adopted in other countries, have been thrown on the junk pile of history.
Why do you think ours has survived so long, so intact?
Why has it lasted so long? Well, I think there are three reasons. I think the remarkable thing about the delegates, above all else, was that they blended a very practical politician's awareness of the springs of human action, how and why people tick, along with a great deal of reading and study of all forms of government in the past. And they had a tremendously important sense of the interplay between the two, how the institutions they would create over the long pull would affect the way leaders behaved and people behaved. I sometimes think, when I reflect on the select committees on the Iran-Contra crisis, that I rather wish they would ask themselves, is there anything in the organization of the White House, the people just under the president, that explains why twice within 15 years we have had very high in the government what attitude of disregard for law, contempt of law, Whereas one of the things that is insured is 200 good years on the whole in American history has been that principle that even the highest officials in the government are subject to law.
Hmm. Do you think that contempt perhaps for the law came because of the nature of the men themselves who had the power at the time?
Well, I think that the positions, let's say, provided a fertile soil. Of course, it's partly the individuals. But I think the uncontrolled growth of White House staff, with their enormous power, plus the fact, if one thinks about it, that most of the men appointed to White House positions in the last 25 years have, in a public sense, been nobodies when they were appointed. Not all of them, but most of them had no place in public life, and thus they were wholly dependent on one man's smile or frown to lose their power, and began to forget that they owed obligations to, well, as we say today, we the people, that it wasn't just that one man, a monarch, that they owed obligations to. And I think that's partly an institutional, so I think it was the conjunction of the two.
Do you agree with people like Attorney General Edwin Meese that we should concentrate on the intent of the Constitution? I mean, first of all, how can we? How can 200 years ago the founding fathers have known about things like life support systems, computers, new technologies? But just as a term, just as a principle.
The word original intent and intent, you know, they're awfully slippery words. What is meant by them? I think there's sort of two extremes of meaning that it's worth mentioning. One is, what did the framers consciously think and intend? And as you suggest, there are lots of things today that the framers couldn't possibly have foreseen or had any intent one way or another about. Then there is also a much broader underlying purpose or policy. Let me put a fairly simple illustration. The first ironworks in the United States, I think, was in Saugus, Massachusetts, and it was started a little after 1800 sometime. If you'd asked those framers who were still around, do you intend Congress to have power to regulate employment at the Saugus ironworks? Of course, they said no. Not possibly. In 1937, the Supreme Court interpreted the commerce power to hold that Congress did have that power. So if you talk specific intent, it was at war with the specific intent. If you define the purpose more broadly, as John Marshall, our greatest Chief Justice, did, and say the evident purpose of the Constitution was to give the federal government power to regulate those things that affect more states than one, and to reserve to the states the power to deal with things that affect only the state, then you would say, well, the Saugus Ironworks in 1800 didn't affect more states than one, so anybody would notice it, whereas U.S. steel mills in Pittsburgh or Jones and Laughlin obviously did. The economy had changed, the processes of manufacture had changed. I think the intent in the broader sense of the underlying purpose or policies, what ideals motivated the framers, remains important. I think there are times when we go beyond it. I couldn't say that with historical accuracy, that the intent of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment was to wipe off the books all the laws discriminating against women. But I think the Supreme Court's decisions that laws discriminating against women violate the Equal Protection Clause today was a wise and right decision. I think the great bulk of the country thinks so, too.
My guest is Archibald Cox. The 14th Amendment is one that's evoked quite often It's been referred to almost as a second Bill of Rights for for us.
Yes, because what it did, put most simply, and sloughing over some hard questions, the Bill of Rights guaranteed citizens' liberties only against invasion by the federal government, by the president or the Congress. The 14th Amendment guaranteed us individual rights against infringement by the states. And so it's a Bill of Rights against the state, if you're not speaking too precisely, because they're not exactly coextensive.
Do you think that there's a need for a new constitutional convention? There's been a lot of talk about that, a cry for it almost.
Well, a cry, if I may say so, about rather foolish things. No, I think there is no need for a new constitutional convention. I suggest in the book, and I've sometimes said, that part of the genius of the framers was their ability to say enough but not too much. That they were able, they spoke, when you think about it, I spoke of the phrase to regulate commerce among the several states, leaves all kinds of questions unanswered. Guarantee against deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Again, the freedom of speech is a majestic phrase, but its precise application is, was left to the future. They couldn't agree on a lot of things. That's why they put them off. And I think they were wise enough to know that they couldn't foresee a lot of things. And one reason the Constitution has lasted 200 years, I think, is that the Supreme Court, when it became the authoritative voice of the Constitution, has been able both to meet the needs of the community at the time of the decisions, but it has also followed a method of constantly preserving the links with the past, as I would put it as a law professor, regarding itself as bound, but not too strictly, by the continuing, evolving body of law that is ever constant, even though it's ever changing.
That seems almost an ideal, though. I mean, lately it seems that nominations to the Supreme Court are politically motivated. I know this has also happened in the past as well, but is there a danger that the Supreme Court could actually become a political tool for the powers, whatever powers that be at the time?
When I'm in a black mood, I worry greatly about that. I'm essentially an optimist believer. I've always read a lot of history, especially our American history, and when you see what people have accomplished in the past, you have to believe if we get to work, we can accomplish like things in the future. But I do worry that the tendency today, right immediately, is to politicize the court, to, I really think, in the selecting of judges, I'm thinking of all the federal courts now, in a degree that has never been done before, far more explicitly. We'll go and get people we think will decide the cases right. And it's also the court has, say, in the last 25, maybe 35 years, been a good deal freer in deciding cases according to what the justices think meets the needs of the country, and a good deal less attentive to what I call the continuing body of law. And those two trends sort of feed each other. But there's always been some policy. It's a dilemma. It's the only way you can define the role of the court, in my judgment, is to state two inconsistent propositions. On the one hand, it must follow the law, and on the other hand, it must meet the needs of the community. But I do suggest, to put it briefly, that this is probably what would happen if you and I went out and met some people on the street and asked them How do you expect a judge to decide a case? Do you want him to do what he thinks is right or to follow the law? Well, once we persuaded them we were serious and not crazy, I think they'd say, no, he should follow the law. If we then said, well, you mean he should be bound by precedent regardless of justice? Oh, no, he ought to do what's just.
Mm.
I think, but, you know, sure, it's an ideal, it's an aspiration. But I suggest to you that, in a way, if we, our aspirations are part of us, in the broad sense, all of us, but also individuals, and that if we work on the aspirations, seek to achieve them, the consciousness of the effort and the confidence of the people that the effort is being made by the court is enough, even though they can never achieve the ideal perfectly.
Mm. Is there any truth to the rumor that had President Kennedy lived, you might have been appointed to the Supreme Court?
Well, that has been printed, and I'm sure I don't know. There was an interesting little incident to the former Solicitors General. I feel a great bond. There haven't been very many of them. And when I was Solicitor General, while President Kennedy was still alive, former Solicitor General Stanley Reed was a retired Supreme Court justice. And just after the present Justice White, who was a Kennedy appointment, was put on the court, he was seated next to my wife at a dinner party. And he said, well, I'm very sorry that Archie wasn't appointed on this occasion. Well, because who's appointed is largely a matter of fate. And the pendulum may swing toward a person once, but if it doesn't swing all the way, it never swings back so far again. So that, at least, I suspected he was right, and that spared my ever, you know, sort of drooling at the prospect.
You would have wanted the job. Oh, I mean, of
course. Oh, there's... I'm not sure that the job of Solicitor General isn't more satisfying than even being on the court, but everybody would want to be on the court.
My guest is Archibald Cox. He's one of the leading authorities on constitutional and labor law. He has written a new book called The Court and the Constitution, and we're going to talk about probably what you all want to hear about, Watergate, in just a moment. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. My guest is Archibald Cox. He has held numerous appointed positions in government, including the Solicitor General, and he was the first Watergate prosecutor until he was fired under the order of President Nixon in 1973. There is a man right now who is in the limelight who had a great effect on your life. I'm talking about Judge Robert Bork. He was the man who ultimately did fire you as special prosecutor. You must be inundated with questions about your opinions of his worth or unworth for the Supreme Court. Are you reluctant to talk about that?
Yes, I haven't and don't intend to. It's a very proper question for anyone in your position to ask. But I ask them and any listeners to understand. I have a very strong feeling that one shouldn't either act on public questions in public office or give advice on public questions where an impartial, dispassionate advice may or may not, but may be mixed up with wholly irrelevant personal feelings that have been bruised in one way or another. And no one can tell how to eliminate those feelings. I don't think anyone can even tell whether he has bruised personal feelings. There's always the subconscious. So I've simply thought it was more seemly for me to refrain from speaking on this subject. And I intend not to speak on it.
Okay, I'll respect that. When you were appointed special prosecutor, why did they choose you? I know Elliot Richardson had studied law under you, and you had known him for a long time, but certainly he wasn't just appointing a
friend. Well, I asked Elliot Richardson, why me? And I said, I've never prosecuted anybody. Why should I be special prosecutor? He said, oh, you can hire yourself some first-rate prosecutor. You have two things that are very important. You have the confidence of the United States Senate as a man who's fair, a man of principle and integrity. And two, you have the, from being a solicitor general, you have the confidence of the American lawyers. And that, too, is very important. So I guess he's as good a person, his advice on why he did it is as good as anybody's.
Could you have predicted the kind of constitutional conflict that ultimately resulted from your investigations?
No. My predictions, such as I made, and they were made only to my wife, but I remember this very vividly. We were discussing whether I should accept the invitation or not, and I said, well, this is a no-win job. What I had in mind was that there was a very high degree of probability that we never would get to the bottom of it. And what would be the result? Well, those who hate Nixon people would be saying if Cox weren't so dumb or if Cox hadn't sold out, he'd have found he was guilty. Mm-hmm. And the people who admired Richard Nixon, and there were still a great many, would be saying if Cox hadn't been a Kennedy man, he would have exonerated Richard Nixon. And I'd be left
between a rock and a hard place.
Yes. And, well, she said, you've taken no-win jobs before, as I had on one or two occasions. They've turned out very well. And I said, well, someone ought to engage in this effort to show that our system of government is capable of inquiring firmly and fairly into allegations of wrongdoing at the very highest levels of government. And it's, I guess, as good a person to do it as anyone is a tenured professor at Harvard who isn't going any place in public life anyway. Mm. Well, I was obviously all wrong in my predictions, but that's really an honest story.
You were fired ultimately because you refused to compromise with the White House over the tapes that you had subpoenaed President Nixon to turn over these tapes. Did you ever get to listen to any of these tapes?
I never have.
Never, not even at the archives?
No, I have thought of going to the archives building someday, but to do it, I would have to put on a wig and a false mustache. I don't think I'd look very good in a wig and false mustache.
Were you very frustrated after the firing to watch the drama going on from the balcony as opposed to being center stage?
Well, I was the thing that really was of concern to me was this was a great constitutional crisis in a sense. There were two great constitutional issues. One was whether, as a matter of law, the president, like everybody under the president, was subject to law and to court orders. And that had never been squarely decided in our courts. And so the courts did, in ordering him to produce the tapes, decide the president was no exception. And that is certainly consistent with our entire history and spirit.
Is this then because it was a criminal investigation rather than something else?
Well, the president had never been subjected, the president himself had never been subjected to a court order before. It had never come to a showdown. People under the president who were acting for him, yes, from the very beginning, Marbury and Madison, but never the president himself. Then the other thing was when the courts did rule that the president has no immunity from law, could this be made real? Or was the law a paper tiger, as it were? As I quote Winston Churchill at one point in the book, democracy should never expose its weakness. If I forced this to a showdown, would all I do is show the weakness of the law and the Constitution as against a determined president who had all the muscle in terms of... And, of course, the only thing that could enforce the law and the court decree was the power of the people. If the people recognized that the ultimate safeguard of our liberties is the law and an independent judiciary, and used their moral and political power, then Richard Nixon would have to produce the tapes. On Friday, he refused. On Saturday, Tuesday, he sent his lawyer to court to say he would do it. And I honestly think, although I was, of course, I had some personal feelings, that my whole mind was so concentrated on that very critical question that the rest of it didn't much matter to me.
You say it was the mind of the people. President Nixon had won in 1972 with a landslide victory. Wasn't there a danger that the people weren't going to go along with?
Well, I guess indeed that was why for several months I had been worrying about this. I used to talk about it with my staff. All right, we'll go, and the courtroom part will be easy. We'll make the best argument we can. We'll win or we'll lose. But if we win, and then he says, I won't do it, what do we do? And we would discuss all kinds of...
At one point you say it could have resembled a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta.
Well, yeah, at one point one of the lawyers on the staff, I think seriously said, well, let's get a posse of United States Marshals and send them to the White House to demand the tapes. And someone else said, well, but they'll be met by the security guards. And another staff person said, it won't be the security guards, it'll be the Marines. And to that it was added, you may remember there was controversy over the Marines' fancy dress uniform. Yes, and they'll be in their fancy dress uniforms. And it was at that point that visions of Gilbert and Sullivan began to float through my mind.
Just very briefly, because we don't have much time left, why has it taken you 14 years to write about it in the prologue to your new book?
Well, I think other people should pass judgment on Watergate and on me. It's not for me to do.
Thank you very much, Archibald Cox. My guest has been Archibald Cox. He was the first Watergate prosecutor. He's a leading authority on constitutional law and labor law. He's written a new book entitled The Court and the Constitution, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.